I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Alistair Hunt. Alistair is an assistant professor of English at Portland State University. I ran across his existence by finding a seminar that he spoke at March 27th, 2009 for the Center for Humanities at University of Wisconsin-Madison. They held a seminar on what is human, and Alistair spoke at that and articulated what I have referred to on this show in the past as a critique of human racism or speciesism as a basis for human rights. So welcome, Alistair.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, this is the focus of your dissertation and the work that you'd done as a doctoral student?
Yeah, it is. My dissertation looks at the figure of the human within rights discourse, and in particular looking at the birth of modern rights discourse in the late 18th century, and I'm very much interested in the ambivalences within what is ostensibly a very transparent category, but when read a little bit more closely, it seems to be quite troubling.
Now, my education in the history of ideas was lamentably lacking, and when I started to back into this issue through my political work, talking about contemporary biopolitics, I have now gone back to the classical Renaissance and Enlightenment sources and try to figure out where some of these ideas come from. Many people would root our contemporary discourse around citizenship and personhood and the basis of citizenship in the Enlightenment thinkers like Locke. Is that where you start, or do you go back further?
No, that sounds about right to me. I mean, there are arguments to be made that our understandings of the human as a sort of political category, if you like, in which, you know, by being human you have certain kind of political rights. There's an argument to be made that goes back to the early modern period and the Renaissance, but it really gets explicitly and sort of clearly articulated for the very first time in the 18th century. There's a general consensus among historians of human rights that really the first time it gets clearly articulated is in 1789 with the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen by the National Assembly during the French Revolution.
The Rights of Man and the French Revolution.
Yep.
I recently took a look at that, and the opening statement in the French Revolution in that document is very interesting. It says that all men have rights, and I guess there's an attendant rights of women document with that. So it's very specifically all men.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says the only distinctions between people should be based on social utility. I don't know if you've looked at that recently, but it immediately conditions the egalitarian aspect of that declaration by saying that you can make distinctions among people if it's useful to do so.
Yeah, and there's the rub, right? I mean, this has been the beginnings in some ways of the problem. But actually, the first article to which you refer, which says that all men have rights, it actually reads, "All men are born and remain free and equal in rights." This word "birth" or "are born." This phrase has sort of become very, very important in recent studies on human rights. It seems, you know, ostensibly to say that simply by being a human being, because you're a human being, you bear rights, you know, as a human being. Well, the emphasis seems to be on the sort of the simple identity between being human and possessing rights. But of course, the authors of this declaration, they didn't consciously intend it to really include, you know, all human beings, and in fact, they didn't even mean it to include all male human beings. As a response, it was Olympe de Gouges who wrote her own declaration, the Declaration of the Rights of Woman and of the Citizeness, and she was executed, basically for writing this document. I mean, she was regarded as too radical in some way. But what's really interesting about her document is that on the one hand, the fact that she was executed, etc., proves that the writers of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, you know, couldn't even hear her declaration as a genuine declaration or claim of human rights. But then on the other hand, by writing it, she was sort of able to enact this practice of claiming rights, and thereby to sort of prove in some way that she was qualified to have these rights.
Now, you make the point that the discourse around it was specifically that you're born with these rights. So that's very mm-hmm. much in the Lockean tradition, that it's some reference to a notion of natural law, natural rights, God-given, mm-hmm. Self-evident, inalienable, because we have souls. And part of the problem with our contemporary human rights discourse is that as those self-evident features have eroded for us, but you know, the Enlightenment eroded it with secularism, that it doesn't, you know, some claim that to the notion that all beings with souls should have equal rights doesn't seem very plausible nowadays, that we've had to cast about for a different framing of those universal mm-hmm. human rights.
Exactly right. I mean, arguably, you know, the appearance of human rights at the end of the 18th century sort of signals this transition from a theologically founded conception of politics, in which, you know, the sovereign, the monarch, had his right given to him by God, to a secular conception of politics in which it was now the people who had rights, not necessarily because God gave them these rights, but because they were the only ones sort of, you know, available to claim these rights. But what's interesting is that a certain kind of theological residue gets carried over, and it appears precisely in the search for a sort of foundation for a secular notion of rights. And arguably, you see the rights ultimately being founded in, on the one hand, this notion of personhood, which we could understand as simply the capacity for rational reflection and decision making, but on the other hand, there is a sort of biological manifestation of the same sort of foundation for rights, and that gets back to that whole the first article of the French Declaration, which is man, all men are born and remain free and equal in rights. No, it's really the interplay between the I'm a rational being, therefore I have rights, or I was born human, therefore I have rights.
Now, Locke also is a touch point for the rational approach to citizenship and rights bearingness. So who are some of the other people who were foundational for this approach of rational personhood?
Samuel Pudendorf, who was an 18th century natural rights and natural law theorist. Hobbes, obviously a little bit earlier on. He was very, very, very important in the sort of emergence of, you know, like contemporary politics, and especially a certain kind of proto-democratic notion of politics. Then all the sort of late 18th century thinkers like Jeremy Bentham, William Godwin, all these figures were super important.
Now, what's the nature of the argument that just on the basis of being biologically human, we should have rights? I mean, this has become central for some contemporary bioethicists, this defense of human exceptionalism, but it's mostly in reaction to the personhood tradition, where they're upset that we're going to try to expand the categories of rights to include great apes or other, you know, robots or whatever. And, you know, so they've fought back, but there doesn't seem to be any coherent intellectual ground for arguing that humanness, biological humanness, is a ground for being rights-bearing.
Yeah, you're right. And I think it's even worse than that. It's not just that it's intellectually incoherent, but it's actually politically dangerous. I mean, it's a little bit scary. I mean, think about what other kinds of political programs in history have been premised upon a certain kind of biologistic logic, a certain, you know, making that claim that because I have a certain kind of biological heritage, therefore I have certain rights. You know, the reverse being because others don't have a certain biological heritage, they don't have the same or equal rights or potentially any rights at all. And one thing I talk about in my research is the contemporary pro-life movement, in particular an organization called Personhood USA. It's very, very interesting. It's a grassroots Christian organization which takes a sort of explicit goal to ban abortion, and they work by attempting to pass laws at the level of state which would mean that laws would be interpreted, all laws would be interpreted in such a way that any reference to person, individual, or human being in state legislation or the Constitution would refer to any organism, for example, with the genome of Homo sapiens. So, and what they're doing is really fascinating because they're redefining the very, if you like, existence or ontology of the legal the legal category of the person, and they're giving it a biological basis. And this is something that it's intellectually incoherent in some way, but it's also slightly scary.
Well, it's
because it has ramifications beyond the sort of issue of abortion.
Well, I completely agree with you that the notion that rights are conditional to some kind of biological characteristics. You know, in the first place, what does it mean to have a human genome if we share 99% of our genome with other animals and there's all this internal variation between human beings? You know, is it, if you find somebody who has hair all over their body, are they not a rights-bearing citizen because they don't have the human genome, what it's supposed to be? But you're absolutely right that, you know, that the predecessors of that are the kind of eugenic correctness. But the irony here is that they accuse personhood advocates, you know, rational personhood advocates or enlightenment personhood advocates of being the ones who are in the Nazi tradition because of the battles over the fetus and the brain dead. They say that because you want to take away the legal citizenship of the fetus and the brain dead, you're in the Nazi tradition, not us.
The irony is that an ethical stance based upon rational personhood is detached from any sort of biological residue, because the position is that personhood, no matter where it appears and what sort of biological form, if you like, or even what technical form, then it still makes an ethical claim upon us. So in that sense, then the rational personhood position is very distinct from something like eugenics. But I do think the rational personhood argument or position also has its kind of limits. This is a larger argument, perhaps.
Limits in the sense of what?
Limits in the sense that what it does is it reproduces a certain kind of subject, a certain kind of conception of the individual or the self. And it understands politics and ethics, if you like, to sort of operate through the idea of a rational subject. And personally, I find that, I don't think this quite captures our actual experience of ethics, if you like, and even of politics. It's not that there aren't any individuals or there aren't any selves or there aren't any, there isn't any reason, but I think that politics often happens at those times when we don't know what to do, when there are no sort of alibis or foundations for our decisions, when in some sense we come undone when faced with others, when faced with sort of the range of possibilities.
But you don't have a problem with the exclusion of non-rational subjects from the citizenship, from the polity. I mean, it's just that you don't think that the description of what a polity is captured by the notion that we're all just individual, autonomous subjects rationally debating one another.
Yeah. I don't find it to be completely compelling to say that only rational subjects can have interests, and only rational subjects should have those interests taken into account when we're sort of making ethical and political decisions. I think there's at least the possibility that it reproduces a certain kind of it's premised upon a certain kind of arbitrary decision, which in some ways aligns it with a certain with the biologistic position in some weird way.
There's an arbitrary psychologism and an arbitrary biologism, as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, I think any notion of citizenship, any notion of sort of political rights, always wants to make some kind of substitution between a certain kind of ontology, a certain mode of existence, and then the possession of rights, or the sort of the act of bearing rights. And within this sort of simple version of human rights, for example, we have being human on the one hand, however that's defined, whether it's biological or through psychological, intellectual, etc. And then on the other hand, we have the actual sort of possession of rights. And human rights discourse seems to always want to collapse the two. We could even say confuse the two. That's why it's a very powerful position, in fact, you know, because you bear rights as a human being, and they're the same thing. Being human and bearing rights are the same thing. And I think even the rationalist or sort of rational personhood version of this wants to collapse what are in fact two distinct things. On the one hand, being a rational person, and on the other hand, bearing rights, or having a sort of a claim upon us, if you like, a sort of claim, an ethical claim, political claim upon us. And I'm not convinced that they're the same thing.
Really appreciate your coming on today. I've been speaking with Alistair Hunt. He's an assistant professor of English at Portland State University. We were talking about the ideas that he's been developing about the basis for human rights, whether saying that all humans have equal rights is in some sense racist and biologist and philosophically irrational. And hopefully we will soon be able to read about those ideas in his forthcoming dissertation book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was nice to talk.
And now we finish the second half of an interview with Gary Greenberg about his book, The Manufacturing of Depression. For the first half of the interview, go to ieet.org. One of the arguments about medicalization is that there's an advantage to it, that as opposed to people blaming themselves or feeling that they're just spinning their wheels, that medicalization allows people to blame a part of their life, go to somebody for help, or go to you as a therapist and say, I think I'm suffering from X, instead of I'm born this way. I have the bad humors or whatever. Mm-hmm. For instance, this debate has happened around homosexuality, which has also been a DSM controversy. Originally, homosexuality was apparently nothing. There wasn't even a word for it until a couple hundred years ago. And then it was a moral failing, and then it was a psychiatric diagnosis, and now it's a lifestyle. And at different points, it has different political consequences. So when it's when it went from moral failing to psychiatric diagnosis, that was progress. And then it went from psychiatric diagnosis to lifestyle, that was also a kind of progress. So are you advocating the same thing for a certain range of what people currently think is depression, that people should stop seeing it as a psychiatric diagnosis and see it as a normal part of life as a form of this kind of progress?
Well, that wouldn't bother me very much, but I think if I have to be saying something, what I would say about that is that there is value to the disease model, but the value of the disease model is not what we think it is. If we think of disease, and what we think of now as disease is in the classic sense is a form of suffering that's caused by a biochemical pathogen that has nothing to do with our will. And that's what you were talking about before, this part of you. And so that helps you with the destigmatization.
Right.
And the value of that approach to disease is immeasurable. It has helped people with mental illnesses. It has helped people with addiction. It's helped people with syphilis get better. And you can't argue with that. But as I outline in my book, that idea of disease just comes to us 150 years ago. It's brand new. And it was lucky. It was discovered by accident, and it was discovered through drugs. Drugs started it. First they found the drugs, then they found the diseases they would cure. Mm-hmm. And it
starts with opiates and amphetamines, really, doesn't it?
Well, actually, the story that I tell, it starts with syphilis. Yeah, it starts with the cures for syphilis. Opiates and amphetamines, well, opiates anyway, were given for thousands of years without anybody knowing why they worked. Same thing for aspirin and quinine. Curing cholera in the 19th century by taking the handle off the water pump, that famous story, which is a true story, mm-hmm. nobody knew there was a germ causing cholera. There was no germ theory of disease in 1840. Mm-hmm. So as the drugs were developed that could cure diseases, the idea came along that all diseases must be like this. All mm-hmm. our suffering must be like this. And so slowly over time, we have come to expect, aided by pharmaceutical companies,
financial motives.
Yeah, to gain in that deal, we have come to expect that all of our suffering will be traceable to a single target for a magic bullet. Mm-hmm. And that idea of disease is, I think we're at the end of it. I think that this is why the pharmaceutical companies are having trouble. The low-hanging fruit has been picked. Mm-hmm. And we're going to run into all of these immune diseases and autism and all these conditions that are multiplying. And where are they coming from? And they're not going to yield their secrets to the magic bullet model. That's my guess. But if you go up one level of analysis, what's the disease? A disease is a form of suffering that we deem worthy of devoting social resources to relieving. Having a claim on a biochemical disease is a really good way to get that kind of those resources because we don't hold it against you. Mm-hmm. Sure, we'll help you. It's a very cruel society we live in. We're very conditional with who we help.
So medicalization allows a claim on society.
Medicalization allows a claim on society. It allows you to say there's something wrong with me that's not my fault. Mm-hmm. But why do we make it so hard? In fact, if a disease is just a way to make a claim on those resources, and there are 1 in 5 people unhappy enough to meet the DSM criteria for depression, that's a problem. I'm not saying that's not a problem. I'm just saying maybe it's not a biochemical problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a social problem. Mm-hmm. And so to get back to where you started with this question, the incidence of depression, the increased incidence of depression is really a call to look at the conditions of our society that might have something to do with why there are so many unhappy people. What do people complain about in my office? They complain about they can't make their lives work. They're tired. They don't have time for sex. Their children, they don't understand their children. They're always on their cell phones. The daycare, the nightmare of a two-career couple, the whole thing. This is what people complain about. This is what's bumming them out. Mm-hmm. It's what's making them stressed and tired and all that. Well, is that a disease?
Okay. It's modernity.
That's right. The disease, the pathology may be more out there mm-hmm. than in here. And it would be value in looking at that as a disease, which is to say in a systematic way to try to understand what are the, quote, pathogens that are responsible for this trouble. And all the time that we're working on drugs, I don't have anything against drugs, but all the time we're working on drugs, maybe we should work on some of those other things too, mm-hmm. which, you know, this latest healthcare debate makes me despair. Talk about depressing. Makes me despair of that happening. I mean, we don't even want to help people have health insurance.
Well, it did mandate that there'll be calorie counts on every fast food menu. So.
Which can't hurt.
Yeah. It did not mandate us. Who's the guy? Bach's book on happiness. He thinks that we should put funding into bicycle pathways and things like that. He disparages the notion that there's any relationship between inequality and happiness, which the more social democratic critics would dispute. But he says that we should be investing in things like physical fitness, that would have more of an impact. And you actually recount in your book that helping to build your house or building your house was part of what helped you.
Right. That was a very funny moment because
we should give loans to people or tax breaks to people to
build a house,
build their own house.
yeah. Because you know, here they're explaining that in terms of the, you know, swinging a hammer and the large muscle movement. Well, whatever.
We don't have much more time, but I wanted to ask you one last question about drugs, which is we've had a long time association. You know, I'm a big enhancement type mm-hmm. advocate. I'm also progressive and a sociologist, and so very cognizant of these critiques that you're making. So I agree with a lot of what you're saying. But we probably will be inventing a number of psychoactive drugs in the next couple decades that will be very targeted at creating different kinds of moods and will allow us to enhance ordinary people's psychoactive experience in various kinds of ways. And one of the debates has been about whether the FDA, in the first place, is capable of judging the safety and efficacy of the existing drugs, because the SSRI story has been so depressing about their inability to gather the kind of evidence that would have shown that, you know, Prozac was marginally effective for only the very severely depressed, apparently. Do you think that the FDA is an adequate agency, that it needs to be reformed? You tell part of the story in your book.
Well, I think that actually the answer to your question is in the SSRI story.
Yeah.
Because while the research does show that only severe depressions respond to the drugs, that's actually a function of the testing. It's not a function of the drugs. 10 million people aren't taking Prozac who didn't have severe depression in the first place, aren't taking Prozac and continuing to take Prozac and drugs like it because it doesn't work. They're taking it because it helps them in a way that doesn't show up on the tests.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, will we write tests that are honest?
About placebo?
Honest about what the drugs actually do.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's really going on with these SSRIs is they're changing people's personalities.
Mm.
Kramer wrote about that very eloquently mm-hmm. as a side effect. It's not a side effect. It's what the drugs do.
Mm-hmm.
People get changed and they like themselves better. They fit in better, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, they get less depressed. This is not a mystery.
Right.
But the tests don't test for that. If you developed a test that tested for, you know, confidence and rejection sensitivity, these tests do exist, and then use those to validate the drugs, you would solve that problem, but you'd create a new problem. The new problem mm-hmm. you'd create is suddenly you would be acknowledging that these are what you would call enhancement drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the FDA is in a whole new business, isn't it?
Right.
And I'm not actually sure I want the government in charge of that business. I'm not sure I want the government deciding in what ways it's okay for me to change my consciousness. I mean, they already do decide this, mm-hmm. but now deciding it in terms of prescription drugs, I don't know that I want the doctors involved. I don't know why I want the regulators involved in this question. I don't have a better solution.
It's not just personality in general. There's the personality psychologists have this five-factor model, mm. and they've looked at which factors are related to depression and happiness. And neuroticism is the one mm. of the five factors that seems to be the most related. And there is some evidence that taking these drugs moves you from on the slider scale from one end of neuroticism to less neurotic. And so you're saying you don't think that that's something that the FDA should be able to say it's good for people to take a drug? That
I guess I shouldn't say I don't believe they ought to. I think that we need to move very, very cautiously
mm-hmm.
with getting the government into that business. It frightens me a little bit. I mean, I don't like the way they are in the business now, where they basically say if you use the drugs that we don't condone, you go to jail.
Right.
I just as soon see them get out of that business first. I'd live with that.
Brother.
Yeah, right. Goodbye. And and after that, maybe, you know, but I don't know that the same people that say these really irresponsible things about consciousness-altering drugs and that have overlooked these really obvious problems for 50 years since they've been testing these drugs, I don't know that I really want them in charge of this. I don't know that they're capable of it.
Mm.
On the other hand, if the question is, should there be a policy that allows this kind of drug development and drug taking as a sanctioned practice, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know that it should conform to the model of drug approval.
Mm. Well, we've been talking about manufacturing depression, the secret history of a modern disease, which is a personal narrative combined with a fascinating and very lyrically written history and political diagnosis of the problem of depressive diagnosis. Thank you so much for joining us, Gary Greenberg.
Been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.